Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. We're in the middle of the peak summer travel season, and even if you don't have a trip booked yet, there's still opportunities near and far to get out of town. For people with unlimited funds, planning a trip is as easy as writing a check. But for the rest of us, travel takes careful consideration to make sure we're getting maximum return on our vacation dollar. And most successful trips are the result of smart planning and an open mind. Pauline Frommer is editorial director for Frommer's Guidebooks. The company was started by her father, Arthur, whose Europe on $5 a day has influenced generations of travelers and travel writers. Pauline, welcome to Think.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks so much.
Is there a difference to you between vacation and travel?
Sure. There's lots of people who travel for work, and they don't get to see anything of the place that they're in. So I would say that that's probably not a vacation. For me, whenever I travel, I try and get some pleasure out of it. I think travel is one of the greatest things you can do in your life. There's no better education. There's no better way to figure out who you are as a human being than to put yourself in these oddball or at least different situations and see how you react.
We'll be taking questions from listeners as they come in today. If you'd like to ask Pauline a question or get a travel recommendation, you can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. And before we get to those specific destinations, I thought we'd talk a little bit about how we can get there smartly. First, though, what tips do you have on saving on airfare?
It is so hard to save on airfare nowadays, unfortunately. Ever since the conglomeration of the airlines into several monopolies, there just is not the type of competition that existed as little as a year ago. So some people get very smart about points. Saving miles. That is changing with some of the airlines. Some of the airlines are now changing their requirements to how much money you spend rather than how many miles you fly. But if you use a credit card to accrue points, that's a good way to get free flights or at least upgrades. You have to be smart about what days of the week you fly out, and that will vary by the destination. So if you can use a good website, one that gives you a very broad search, like Momondo.com or Kayak.com or Doohop.com, and be clever or be at least flexible in your dates, you may find some savings. But frankly, this summer, it's been harder than ever before to save money on airfares thanks to these airline consolidations.
Yeah, I think we got a little spoiled, particularly after 9/11. The airfares dropped and we were used to seeing these really low fares. And I feel like maybe they've come back up to maybe what's a more realistic level. I don't know what you think about that.
They've come up. They're actually still slightly lower than they were before 9/11, so that's the good news. The bad news is they're going up and up. I'm not sure what realistic is. There is really no set price on any flight. Every seat costs a different amount. A lot depends on when you book. The worst time you can book is way in advance. A lot of people think if I book 10 months out, I'll get the best deal. Not so. The airlines know they've got you then. Mm. They tend not to release the cheaper seats until about 22 to 30 days before the flight. Actually 12 weeks before the flight. There was an interesting study by one of the large sellers that showed when you should book. Domestically, it's about 12 weeks before the flight. But oddly enough, if you're going to South America, you'll pay the least if you book 3 months out. If you're going to Central America, the best thing is to book 3 weeks out. It really varies by the destination.
You're really playing a little game of chicken there, particularly when you get closer to the day. That might make some people nervous booking that close.
Well, for some places, it really can pay off. The Caribbean, actually, if you're planning to go there, usually the best prices are within a month of travel.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned using miles, and I feel like for people who use miles, typically they're with, of course, one specific airline, and you're kind of playing this balancing act between cashing in your miles and getting a free ticket versus what does that ticket actually cost, and maybe it would be more worth your while to save those miles for a more expensive ticket?
Well, right now, because the airlines have changed their programs so drastically and they're looking at how much you paid and giving you more miles if you've paid more, for people who don't travel that much and who aren't collecting miles through credit cards, I'd say the best strategy is to simply go with the cheapest ticket from whatever airline and to heck with loyalty. However, if you're somebody who does collect miles with credit cards, who travels a lot, you can still get good deals or at least upgrades by being loyal.
Okay, so we've got our ticket purchased, however we decide to go ahead and do that. Next up for a lot of people, of course, is packing. I wonder if you have any tips on being a more efficient packer. It seems to me like every time I travel, I always end up bringing something where it's like, I could have left that at home and maybe had a little lighter suitcase.
Yeah, I only own carry-on bags because that limits me. So even if I'm traveling for 3 weeks, I have to fit it in my carry-on. And that makes me less of a slave to my luggage. That means if I don't like the hotel, I can move. I can take public transportation from the airport to the hotel and save money that way. So get a smaller bag and make lists and actually stick to them. That's the trick. Sometimes you can get more in the smaller bag and have your clothes wrinkle less if you roll them rather than laying them flat. That doesn't work with chiffons, but it certainly works with other types of fabrics.
You know, the other nice thing about that carry-on bag, obviously, too, is you don't have to worry about your bag getting lost.
And you don't have to pay for it.
You don't have to pay for it, as most airlines are charging for that checked bag. And also, on top of that, it's just faster. You're not hanging around that baggage carousel.
Absolutely. Time is money when you're on vacation, and these little things do add up.
I always like to use just a carry-on bag as well, and I think part of the strategy for me at least, too, is, you know, you can do laundry in a foreign country. They wash clothes over there, too, and that's another way to save on your packing, I guess.
Yeah, you just you wear dark colors, you wear things that you can mix and match. Unless you're going to some formal event, you get rid of the idea that I'm going to go to the opera, and you don't pack formal clothes, and you're just strategic about it. And worse comes to worse, you go shopping in the destination, and heck, that can be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that may be part of the reason to go in the first place, right?
Right, absolutely.
So once you've made it to your destination, if you're going more than a couple of time zones away, you'll probably be dealing with jet lag. How do you minimize jet lag?
There is no way to minimize jet lag. I am sorry to say. I travel all the time. I've tried all kinds of remedies. None of them work. You can try. I think the things that work best are staying hydrated, because you'll be more tired overall if you're thirsty, if your body doesn't have enough water, and getting into the sunlight when you're in your destination. But there are no magic pills to pop. I know there are some people who try and get closer to the time change before they go on vacation. I don't have time, or I'm not organized enough to do that. I think very few of us are. I think you just have to expect to be jet lagged.
Is there a certain number of time zones that you find to be the worst as far as jet lag goes?
I think it's worse which direction you're going.
Really?
I find it much harder to go, say, to Europe than to return, even though the amount of time is the same. Somehow it's harder to get up earlier than to have to sleep later.
And I suppose some of that has to do with when you're going to Europe, oftentimes you're going to be trying to sleep on the plane over there.
Yeah, I actually like daytime flights to Europe. There aren't that many of them, but you get tired from being on the plane, and then when you get to the destination, you go to bed, and you're more likely to get on the local time a little bit quicker that way.
Yeah, because the trick to going to Europe is oftentimes if you fly overnight, you get there at, let's say, I don't know, 8 or 9 in the morning, and you really have to push yourself to stay up at least to a reasonable hour so you can try and get on track.
Yeah, although there are certain nations where you have to get on track less. For example, if you go to Spain, a lot of the museums stay open to 7 or 8 at night, and you don't eat dinner till 11 anyway. So you can kind of stay on American time if you go to Spain, less so if you go to the UK.
Yeah, if you go to Spain and you show up for dinner at 11 and let's say you have a 6-hour time difference, it looks like you're being very fashionable and with the crowd. And the truth is you're really showing up for about 5 o'clock your time.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It's a less painful change to make.
I've got an email from Maxine in Dallas who says, can you please ask Ms. Frommer what she thinks about staying in Airbnb properties instead of at a hotel, particularly in places like Manhattan and big cities?
Well, it's illegal in Manhattan.
Really?
There are certain cities where you cannot rent an entire apartment for less than 30 days legally. That's the case in Las Vegas, in San Francisco, in Paris, in New York City. So you do run a small risk using Airbnb in those cities. You can use Airbnb if the owner of the apartment stays on the site. Mm. That being said, I love Airbnb. I've used it all over the place, and I've had wonderful experiences, paid much less than I would for a hotel. You know, when you use Airbnb, you get to review the place you're going, and they review you as a guest. So there's some inbuilt safety in that. And also, you pay your money to Airbnb. They don't release it to the person you're staying with until after you've been there for a night. So I think it's a great system. I love it.
Aside from the financial savings, do you find that it's a different experience than staying in a hotel, or maybe it's a way to experience your destination in a different way?
Oh, it's totally different than staying in a hotel. I often do it the very cheap way, which is not renting the entire apartment, but just renting a room in the apartment and staying with the owner. So you actually get to meet an owner. You have to remember, in many cities, hotels only exist in the commercial zones. So you're staying in an area that's going to be totally dead at night because it's where people do business. The restaurants are going to be only for tourists because the locals are going to be eating in the residential areas for the most part. Whereas when you do Airbnb or Wimdu or Roomarama or HomeAway, these are all companies that allow you to rent in local areas, you're going to be living life like a local, which I think is much more interesting.
This is a time of year when many families, of course, are traveling. Are there ways to ensure kids get the most out of a trip?
I think it depends on the age of the kid, and I'm a mom. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer if your child is under 6, do what you want. Your kid will be happy wherever you are. And just make sure you give the kid some time to run around and scream every day and just, you know, get the energy out. But don't think you can't go to a destination that's museum heavy just because you're traveling with a small child. They'll be okay in the museum, and then you take them to a playground, and then you go to another cultural site. You don't have to just go to theme parks and beaches with small kids. With older kids, you do have to figure out what's going to make them happy. With my teen, I let her pick for one day, or depending on the length of the trip, 2 days of the trip, she gets to plan it. And that way, she complains less on the other days because she knows her day will come.
We're talking today with Pauline Frommer about the world of travel. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back with more of your travel questions after a short break. Bye.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Pauline Frommer, and we're talking about travel. If you have a travel question or would you like a recommendation, you can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or send us an email at think@kera.org. So Pauline, before we took a break, we were talking about family travel. I'm curious if you have recommendations for single travelers.
Single travelers generally do better price-wise by doing the types of vacations that couples don't. Unfortunately, for tours, for most cruises, there's going to be a hefty single supplement charged for doing it alone. So you have to be careful. If you do want to take a tour, many tour companies will waive the single supplement in the off-season. And Norwegian Cruise Lines has actually created solo cabins. They're the first cruise line to do so. They're really nice. They're actually in a part of the ship where you have your own lounge for singles, so people traveling alone can meet one another. But I think other than that, I think traveling alone is a great way to see the world, because instead of spending all your time looking at your travel companion, you're looking out and you're meeting people. When I travel alone, which happens a lot, even though I'm married with kids, because I'm a travel writer, I have to travel alone a lot, I'll go and eat at the bar at a restaurant and talk to the people around me. Or I'll do something like, there are these free greeters tours in many cities now, where locals take you around to sites of local interest for free. And it's a wonderful way to get to know locals. Or I'll do something like Airbnb, where I'm going to be staying in the home of a local and thus have kind of an inbuilt social community a little bit.
I've also heard about if you're going to certain countries where maybe locals are trying to improve their English, the idea of they maybe give you a tour and you converse with them and sort of both sides are getting something out of the deal.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great thing to do. I mean, through social media, sometimes what I do when I have to travel alone, and I have to review restaurants, which is really tough to do on your own, because, wow, do you overeat? So I'll talk to all my friends. I'll send out emails. I'll go on Facebook. I'll say, do you know somebody in the destination I'm going to? And inevitably, somebody does. I reach out to that person and I say, let's have dinner. It'll be on me. And it's often my most memorable meal in the destination because you get to know somebody there. And so it gives you more of a feeling that you've been there.
Let's go to the phones and speak to Roger in Dallas. Roger, welcome to Think.
Yes, thank you very much. My question is, my wife and I will be traveling to Senegal in West Africa in the fall. Our niece is marrying the son of a Senegalese diplomat, so the family we will be interacting with is very westernized. But I was just wondering if Ms. Frommer could suggest a book that or a travel guide or something that we could look at so that we won't step on our own toes, you know. I mean, no, I don't want any social faux pas because I'm dealing with a culture that is significantly different from what I'm used to.
Well, I think it's wonderful,
Roger,
that you're thinking that way. We don't have a guidebook to Senegal, but I'm sure that Lonely Planet would. And you'd be amazed the things that can insult people overseas. For example, if you're in parts of Asia and you show the bottom of your feet to somebody, if you're sitting back in a chair and you prop your feet up on your heels, that's considered a great insult. It's the same as giving somebody the middle finger. So if you look at most guidebooks to the destination, they will list these social faux pas. I know that Lonely Planet has something for Senegal, so I would look at that.
Can you remember a time in your travels where maybe you committed a faux pas, that one that you can share with us anyway, that you didn't that obviously
oh,
you wouldn't have known, you know, until you actually
committed? I'm sure I've committed many faux pas. You know, sometimes my language skills desert me. And I know I've introduced my husband as my wife in many countries. Other than that, it's hard to think offhand, but I'm sure I've done some, and the people I've been with have been too polite to let me know.
When we're traveling internationally, speaking of international travel, is there a best practice as far as exchanging money?
Well, never, ever exchange money with somebody who comes up to you on the street and offers to do it. You can get yourself into big trouble that way. Also, you don't want to exchange too much money at a time, because that's because you're a target for pickpockets when you're traveling. So it's better to travel with plastic and a small amount of money. In most parts of the world, ATMs work absolutely fine. So take out a small amount from the ATM, because that way, if you do get pickpocketed, and pickpockets target tourists because they know they carry around too much money, then at least you're only losing a little bit of money, and you can replace your cards. So that would be my, and you get very good deals generally through ATMs. Yes, certain cards have points taken out, but it's, or not points, but percentages, but it's usually better than you'll get at bureaus de change. And banks tend to be better than those as well. In most countries, you also don't want to change money at the airport or at your hotel desk.
Do people still use traveler's checks?
No.
No? It's kind of gone by the way of the travel
often,
agent.
Yeah, people will just look at you blankly if you try and give them a traveler's check. You know, maybe you carry one or two and you keep it in your hotel room just for safety's sake. But for the most part, they're very hard to use now.
I know there are also some countries where the sort of going exchange rate on the street is much different than what the official government exchange rate. Argentina is an example of a place like that. Have you ever had any experience dealing with that difference?
I am nervous about changing money on the street. Mm-hmm. I've just heard too many stories about that leading to muggings and other bad things. So I don't exchange the money on the street, even if I'm getting a worse exchange rate. I just don't do it for safety's sake. I'm a woman traveler. I mean, you know, there are certain things that women have to do differently than men, and it's important to blend in. One of the tricks I heard from Evelyn Hannon, who runs a wonderful website called journeywoman.com, she goes into a local store, like a drugstore or a supermarket, the very first day that she's in country, just so she can buy something and have a shopping bag from that store. Mm. And then she puts her stuff in that shopping bag because she knows that if people see her, even though she won't look anything like locals, if they see that really local shopping bag, they'll assume she lives there and she'll be able to blend in better.
We have a question from Tony on Grand Prairie via email, who wants to know what you feel about traveling via Amtrak, or I'm assuming any sort of train. He says, we went from L.A. to St. Paul via Portland last summer, and it was a blast. You ever traveled in the U.S. via Amtrak like that?
I love Amtrak. Well, I love traveling by train. Unfortunately, Amtrak shares the tracks with commercial trains, with freight trains. And so often if you have to take a long trip, you can be really delayed. My father once got an ear infection when I think he was in Idaho and had to take the train back to New York from there. And he ended up being 12 hours late. Mm. I love train travel. I wish our trains were as good as the trains in Asia and Europe. I think the government would do well to give more money to trains, because we're being very foolish, putting all our money into highways, which are highly subsidized, and airports, which are highly subsidized, because trains are much greener. They can carry a lot of people. They often can work when storms are happening. I'm a big proponent of trains.
And it's nice to not have to show up so early. A lot of times you can just show up a few minutes early and hop right on that train.
Absolutely. You don't have to go through security. They're very comfortable. There's outlets at your seat most of the time. Most of the trains have Wi-Fi now. I think trains are a great thing, and I wish our country did them better. I wish there was more political support behind them.
Let's go back to the phones and speak to Jennifer in Dallas. Jennifer, thanks for calling.
Hi. I had a quick question about I'm traveling to St. Petersburg, Russia later this fall, and my husband is a little nervous about traveling there just with everything going on with the Ukraine, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were on traveling to Russia and if there should be any worries about us ending up in a gulag breaking rocks.
I don't think you're going to end up in a gulag. I mean, they treat travelers in a very civilized way. Can I ask, have you gotten your visa yet?
Working on it, though. I do know it's a long process, so I am working on that.
It's a crazy, crazy process. They have the most difficult visa process of any country I know of. They will often ask you to list like the last five jobs you had,
wow,
and the names of your bosses, and it's a crazy process. There are companies that expedite it,
yeah,
and even though it's expensive, you may want to do it just because it's such a hassle.
I think we will. We got a visa to Brazil last year, and that was challenging, so I think I'm going for the third-party route.
Think 10 times as hard as getting the Brazilian visa.
Wow.
Truly. It's a crazy process. I don't know why they do that to tourists. But you should be absolutely fine in Russia. I hope you have a lot of cash. Moscow is now the most expensive city, I think, in the world for visitors.
Wow.
But you said you're going to St. Petersburg.
Right.
Slightly
yeah,
less
there.
Expensive. Mm-hmm. Slightly less expensive. And there are some good free tours, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Around the world, free tours have popped up, and they're often better than the tours you pay for because the guides depend entirely on tips. So they have to be really good. And I know in St. Petersburg there are some that are in English that are supposed to be absolutely terrific.
Oh, great. Thank you for the tip.
Sure.
So speaking of visiting places that maybe are a little bit outside of your comfort zone or outside of the usual well-trod areas, how do you feel about package tours as opposed to doing it all on your own?
Well, package tours usually mean that you just get an airfare and a hotel room. I think you probably mean guided
yeah,
tours.
Yeah, sorry, guided tours. Yeah, that's what I meant.
When you're going around with a group of people.
Yeah, so you're sticking with the same group throughout the tour, and you're kind of being shuttled from hotel to bus to that sort of tour experience.
Yeah, I don't think they're any safer, and they're not usually any cheaper. Some people love them because they really like to socialize with others. Other folks find that they put a wall between themselves and the country, that you spend so much time dealing with the dynamics of the group you're in that it can feel less like travel. And often on tours, I hate to say it, but there's always some person who is not somebody you'd want to travel with. And you spend all your time waiting for them to show up because they're late for the bus or listening to them complain about the food. That being said, there are some wonderful tours. I'm more of a loner, personally, and that's just a personal choice. I prefer to be out there and exploring on my own. In terms of safety issues, you can, if it's a really exotic destination, it can be a good idea to register yourself with the U.S. State Department, just so they know that you're in country and they know how to contact you if something should go wrong. Also, the State Department has a very good website in terms of travel warnings. And you should look at that if you're going to a place that has been having problems.
It must be fascinating running a guidebook company because I would imagine that you can look at your sales of books and learn where people are interested in visiting. Are there certain guidebooks that you've noticed maybe spikes in or that you're surprised that more people are buying these days?
Well, I'm kind of proud because the book I wrote, Frommer's Easy Guide to New York City, is our bestseller.
Nice.
Often people don't buy books for places they think they don't need books for. Like even though Las Vegas and Orlando are hugely popular destinations, getting tourist numbers almost as great. This year, New York City is going to get 55 million visitors, a new record. I'm not sure if Las Vegas or Orlando are at that level this year, but they're almost at that level. But a lot of people don't think they need a guidebook to Las Vegas. So even though we have a terrific one, its sales are nowhere near as good as New York. But I think that's because people just assume they'll roll into Vegas, roll up to the table, and just park themselves there and gamble.
Is there a place that you don't currently publish a guidebook for that you've been thinking about adding to your lineup?
Oh, there are many places. There are many, many places. I can't think of one offhand.
Because you guys really...
It's a big world to cover.
And you all really cover it. I mean, between your national destinations and your international places, I mean, how many... Do you know offhand how many guidebooks you all publish?
It's growing. My father and I took back the company just last March. It's now a family-owned company once again. And so our list is slightly smaller than it used to be, but we're adding more books every month. And we pride ourselves on finding the best local experts because we feel that in order to get a real feeling for a destination, you need somebody who's eaten at all the restaurants. You know, our big competition is the web, and a lot of people are going to sites that have reviews from other travelers. The problem with this is when you go to a site that has these types of reviews, you're A, either taking advice from somebody who's eaten at exactly maybe three or four restaurants and stayed in one hotel and may not know that right up the road from that hotel is a nicer hotel that's charging less money, whereas our guidebook authors will go to them all, or you're listening to the advice of a marketer. These websites have gotten so powerful that the large hotel companies and many restaurants employ people to write fake reviews. And you really can't tell the difference between a real review and a fake review. So we're trying to stay on the side of journalism. We have great writers all over the world. Most of them work for local newspapers, local magazines. They know their destinations and they love their destinations and they love introducing new people to those places. And they know everything about them.
We're talking today with Pauline Frommer about the world of travel. If you'd like to join our conversation or if you would like a recommendation from Pauline about the place that you have been considering visiting, give us a call at 800-933-5372 or shoot us an email to think@kera.org. We'll be back with more of your travel questions after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker, and today for Chris Boyd, and our guest today is Pauline Frommer, and we're taking your travel questions. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And how about we go back to the phones and speak to Charlie in Highland Village. Charlie, thanks for calling.
Yes, I was wondering if you had a guide to Mongolia.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, we don't. It's not a place that many people go. I know that there's probably a Lonely Planet or a Rough Guide there. Frommer's tends to hit the more popular destinations, to be perfectly frank.
And how about we go back to the phones to Lynn in Dallas, who I know has a question that you can definitely answer. Lynn, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you so much. I just heard her say a few minutes ago that they have a wonderful guide to New York City. We will be picking that up this weekend. My friend and I, we're going to New York for the first time. Neither of us have been there before, and we, you know, two women traveling along to the big New York City, mm-hmm. and we don't want to go looking at the tall buildings and get hit in the head or pickpocketed. So what can we do to kind of fit in, if that's possible, in the largest city in the world, and just have a great time? Should we try to stay at an Airbnb, or should we stay at a safe motel and use our points and just, you know, what should we do in addition to buying your book?
Well, as I said before, it's actually illegal to use Airbnb in New York City unless you stay in a place where the owner stays on site with you. So if you have points, definitely use them for a hotel. And you don't want to be commuting on vacation, so try and get a hotel in Midtown Manhattan if you can, since you do have points that you can use. In terms of blending in, we New Yorkers, I don't know why it is, but we tend to wear a lot of black. So if you don't wear bright colors, you'll blend in more. But, you know, New York, according to the FBI, is the safest large city in America. So there's not much chance you're going to get pickpocketed here. Truly, it's a safe place, and it's a friendly place. People are always really, really surprised. What's going to be a problem for you, since it's your first visit, is doing everything you want to do, because we just have such a wealth of things to see and do here. The thing you want to do is you want to plan your time geographically. Spend one day downtown, see the Statue of Liberty, see Ellis Island, see the spectacular and moving new 9/11 Memorial and Museum. And you want to get your tickets in advance for that, because it often sells out. It's getting more tourists than any other site in New York, and it's an important new museum. Then spend another day in Midtown. That would be the day you see a Broadway show. You go to Rockefeller Center. You go to the top of the Empire State Building. Spend one day uptown, seeing all our great museums and Central Park. But don't try and run around and see, you know, the Metropolitan Museum the same day you see the Empire State Building, because you'll spend too much time just getting from place to place. You want to be savvy about it if you can.
And I think also, particularly with a place like New York, it's important to be realistic about how much you can actually cram in a given day.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody always thinks they're going to see three museums in a day. And maybe you can do that, but I doubt you'll enjoy it. So pick what really interests you. Pick a good range of things. And then just enjoy. We have so much here. What always blows my mind and breaks my heart is when I see tourists eating in chain restaurants, because you literally can get food that's as inexpensive and so great and from all over the world. The other night, I had an Icelandic dinner in downtown New York. We have an Icelandic restaurant. I've never been to Iceland. I've never tried that type of cuisine before. Boy, is it delicious. And it was a little like going to Iceland, you know, meeting the people who are immigrants from Iceland, trying the food. And you can have those types of experiences in New York City.
For someone who's never been to the city, do you have a recommendation on how to best figure out the subway system? Because it's certainly very handy for those who can figure it out.
I think the subway is a great way to get around. Too many people rely on the hop-on, hop-off buses. And the problem with that is it's almost like seeing the city on TV. You're really removed from it, and you spend a lot of time waiting for them to come. They're not that prompt often. New York City in the 1840s decided to institute a grid system. So it's actually not that hard to figure it out. If you really study a map, you'll see that the numbers go up or down, depending on whether you're uptown or downtown. Downtown can be a little tricky because it's not on the grid. But for the most part, it's pretty easy to figure out the subways. I have lots of tips in my book. I'm not sure how to put them all into a nutshell here.
Let's go next on the phones to Lane and Garland, who wants to know about taking a trip across the Atlantic. Lane, thanks for calling.
Right. Hello.
Hello.
What a timely subject. I'm leaving at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning for Paris.
Oh, perfect timing.
Wow.
I'm going I'm going to the Solar Decathlon, the Department of Energy Solar Decathlon that's being held at Versailles this year. I will be staying in town. I don't mind taking the train back and forth, but I'm going to be so rushed all weekend out there at the event. Can you talk to me about street food in Paris? I haven't been in several years, and the last time I went, we basically did the cafe thing. But I refused, just as you said before, I will not go to this, to the chain restaurants over there.
Good for
you. Is there anything other than that, that street food-wise you can talk about?
Wow. Well, Paris, I mean, has so many incredible markets, and you'll probably pass one. There's also patisseries and boulangeries where you go in and they have prepared foods that are extraordinarily delicious, and you create a picnic lunch, which is great if you're in a rush. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not really a city that has food trucks or many vendors on the streets. There are some storefronts that sell crepes. But for the most part, you go into patisseries, which will have pre-made sandwiches or salads, or you go into a cheese shop and you buy the best cheese you've ever had, and then you go next door and you buy a loaf of crusty French bread, and you go next door to a butcher shop and you buy some sausage, and you just cut it all up and have a feast.
One of the things that frequent travelers may be running into and are lucky enough to run into is maybe you've been to, let's say, New York a few times or Paris a few times, and you really love those cities, but you can only go to the Statue of Liberty or the Eiffel Tower so many times. Do you have recommendations on how you can maybe experience a favorite city through new eyes?
Well, you go to new places. You don't just go to the tourist track places. I mean, with Paris, maybe you spend a day in one of the up-and-coming neighborhoods on the outskirts where many immigrants live, and you eat in a North African restaurant rather than having Parisian food. In New York City, you go to the different boroughs. I've been spending a lot of time exploring the boroughs recently for the update of my book. I went to a place called Arthur Avenue in New York City, which was settled by Neapolitans in the mid-1800s and has extraordinary Italian food, plus people who are hand-rolling cigars, and just so much fun to see. Or I went to the Queen's Museum the other day, which has the panorama of New York City, this huge, I guess, a diorama created for the 1964 World's Fair and updated today. And when you take a tour of it, you learn all about current New York City history, you know, the some of the neighborhoods that no longer exist because of the fires after Hurricane Sandy, the longest subway line. You go to Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, which is the largest Russian community outside of Russia itself. I mean, if you go to one of these big cities like a Paris, a London, or New York, I don't think you can run out of things to do, quite honestly, no matter how many times you visit. There's always something new to explore.
And let's go back to the phones to Joy in Plano. Joy, welcome to Think.
Hi. I love your show today.
Thank you.
Live in New York, so anyone take the subway, get a subway map, and go. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking of moving to Aruba. So I want to make multiple trips and see what it's like, because it will be completely different than Plano. So what would you recommend travel-wise for someone who wants to do that? And so I can also make it affordable to go and see what things are like multiple times.
Yeah. Have you looked into the legalities of moving there?
No, I have not.
I would do that first before you start taking multiple trips, because certain countries don't want people moving to them and may make it difficult for you in terms of getting health care or living there legally. So look into that first, and then I would say make sure you can find an apartment so that you can cook some of your own meals while you're visiting to make sure that you want to go there, because that would be a huge cost. Such companies, yeah?
I'm sorry, as far as legalities, how would I go about doing that?
You would have to talk to the consulate. Or the embassy of Aruba here in the United States and find out, you know, if they will allow you, what you have to do. Certain countries, you have to prove that you have a skill that you can add to their culture, because they don't want you there using their social services if you're not a citizen.
Oh, okay.
Well, thanks a lot, Joy. Now let's go on to, Dan in Fort Worth, who's going to also be visiting Europe. Dan, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. Actually, I have been to Scotland twice, but my son-in-law would like to surprise my daughter for their 10th anniversary to a trip to Scotland, Skye specifically, and I know they want to do it economically. When is the best balance between cost of travel and weather?
Ooh, that's a tough one for Scotland because it can get really drizzly and cold there. You generally got to look at the fringe seasons. So September will be cheaper than August. October will be cheaper than September, and the weather won't be too bad. On the other end of the calendar, May will be cheaper than June, and the weather should be starting to perk up then. April still could be pretty cold and wet and rainy, but it will definitely be cheaper. The problem is with going to Europe in the total off season, if you're going to a rural area in particular, as opposed to going to Edinburgh or Glasgow or one of those other big cities, is sometimes a lot of places close down that cater to tourists, and you really can't find the types of hotels and the types of restaurants that you would in high season.
And let's see, next up, let's try this one, number two. Next up is Gailey and Alan, who has a kind of a general question. Gailey, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hi to you both.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I travel quite a bit, so I had two questions. One of them was just in general, what are the top three most popular guides that you sell? I'm just curious. And then the second question is, what are three recommendations you have of places to go that aren't on the popular list?
Our three most popular guides are New York City, Paris, and Washington, D.C., and places that I think are wonderful that are sometimes off the radar are Belize, a fabulous adventure destination. If you're all adventurous, you'll find yourself swimming into caves and seeing these ancient rooms where Mayans did ceremonies centuries ago, and the pots they used have been calcified to the floor. These pots should be in museums, and there are even skulls from human sacrifices calcified to the floor. I love Belize. Taiwan is a fascinating place and probably the friendliest place I've come across in Asia. Just the loveliest people, really interesting Chinese history and culture because they didn't have the Cultural Revolution, so it's much more unbroken there. And Poland. Poland in Europe has everything that most Western European countries have, great museums, great historic sites, good restaurants, but at a third less money.
Has there been any place that you've traveled to recently that you were really just surprised by, that maybe you didn't know what to expect and were really just blown away by it?
Well, the three I mentioned,
yeah.
Actually. I was just in Taiwan, and it's really amazing. And there are sites you wouldn't expect to see there. For example, when Chiang Kai-shek left mainland China, he took with him all of the best stuff from the Forbidden City. And so you go to this museum, and it has greater treasures than you find in mainland China. Just because, I won't say stole, but he took it with him. Surprising sights in Taiwan.
Our guest today, Pauline Frommer, is the editorial director for Frommer's Guidebooks. Pauline, thanks so much for joining us. I feel like we could have continued this conversation for several hours hence.
That would have been fun. Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Think is produced by yours truly and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Stephen Becker. Thanks for listening and have a great day.